welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in studio with me today is Dan Dross, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And I hope that you'll stay with us through the hour. We have a lot of entertaining discussion, I'm sure, to come along. And you can join us in the conversation at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com, or tweet us your question, #ZestyGarden. Dan, thanks for coming in.
I think it's been the frosty garden this week.
Yeah, I was pretty frosty yesterday morning. Not so much this morning, but
no,
yesterday
yeah,
was pretty hard. Even my tulips were looking just a little bit ragged.
Yeah, everybody was looking a little bit, you know, like they had saying, what the heck is going on in February here? Because, you know, I heard all the way along the Wasatch Front and down all the way to Cedar and beyond, it was pretty frosty. So, you know, that's going to put a damper on some things. And, you know, for other things, it's not really going to matter. You know, we don't have much going on in the garden. We may have started to seed some things, but if you were out transplanting or something like that and you had some plants in, you know, they may look a little bit, you know, a little bit worse for wear for a little while as they kind of deal with those kind of conditions. It doesn't necessarily kill them, but it doesn't necessarily help them either.
Well, someone was telling me that, oh, great, there go my apricots. And I'm like, well, I know that I haven't even seen any blossom, even forsythia out around here. So,
well, I've got forsythia blooming in my yard, and my apricot is probably 1 or 2% flower.
Okay.
So buds are pretty big, but I was like, when I look at that tree every spring, I say to myself, I'd really like a hard frost right around flower time, simply to thin it for me. Otherwise, I just get such a heavy fruit load on it that fruit size is somewhat smaller than I'd like. So, you know, sometimes these things, when it's in your own garden, you know, isn't really too problematic for you. I haven't heard really how the commercial fruit growers coped with the 25 degree temperatures that we had. You know, that's kind of what it was, and a little bit lower than that in some places. And talked to a few farmers down Layton way and stuff, and they said they had temperatures that were in the 25, 26 degree range. And, you know, those are at the point where fruit flowers, depending on what stage of development they are, could, you know, really be injured by that.
So if they weren't opened yet, maybe you just saw a little bit of color, but
well,
they hadn't opened, that'll protect them a little bit?
Not really.
Okay.
So they get damaged even at that stage. And, yeah, when you think about the number of flowers that a fruit tree produces, and then if you have a cold event like this, it's a question of both how cold it got and the duration of the exposure. So the longer it's exposed to those colder temperatures, the more blooms will be injured, or the more injury an individual bloom will get. You know, thinning is one of those big expenses that a grower has to do. You know, people go to the fruit way or down to Spanish Fork and they're buying peaches. I don't think people realize that all of those trees have been heavily pruned, and then that gives you the possibility of pushing energy into the developing fruits. And then not only that, someone goes through and actually thins all those fruit on the tree so that you get a sizey fruit. If you go around to the home orchard, the single tree or the three or four trees that you have, and you look at the fruit load on those trees, I mean, it's way more than the tree really should carry if you want to get any size out of those fruit.
You know, how many bending branches you know are just going to break.
Yeah. And you know, it's okay maybe for the home garden. You know, if the fruit size is a little undersized, that's not really, that's less of a problem for us. But the commercial farmer says there's an optimal size that needs to go into the marketplace, and therefore we've got to remove some of the fruit that is on the tree after it's set. That then is an expense to him. And so, you know, sometimes a frost event can be a beneficial thing, provided it's, you know, the how cold it's gotten and how long it's been exposed to that cold, you know, will, you know, kind of impact how many fruit are going to be on the tree. And what we don't want to have is, you know, super cold temperatures and for a long duration, because that's when, you know, we lose, you know, 80-90% of the fruit, and now we've got ourselves a problem because they may all be clustered in one location on the tree. We don't have them uniformly distributed around the tree as we would like, and that then you know, hurts a farmer in many ways, and that's then going to impact, you know, what's going to happen in the fall.
So as far as the production and the fruit, if most of the tree lost its fruit, but just one section has fruit on it, do you still have to thin them as much as you would as if the whole tree was full?
Well, you know, if you look at how the tree acquires the energy needed for filling those fruits, it tends to come from leaves that are in proximity to the fruit. So it's not taking energy from the other side of the tree, transporting it across to that particular leaf. And so if you don't even thin on that, your fruit size is going to still be small. So, you know, ideally, if you say I want a fruit that's, you know, 4 inches in diameter or something like that, there's research that tells exactly what kind of spacing you should have on your tree, how far apart each fruit should be in order to achieve, you know, kind of what the standard size would be.
So how did this cold affect the commercial farmers, like with their onions and things that they planted earlier?
Yeah, well, the onion growers, I don't know that it's hurt them in any way at all. I was out looking at my own research, and I planted right around the same time that the growers were planting for some of our trials. And the seeds had sprouted, but weren't necessarily emerged yet. Usually that happens right in and around this time frame, but we had a little bit of a cold, and so they were sprouting. So it's a question of whether they were up or not, as to, you know, if they got damaged. And it's been pretty wet, so I haven't really gone out and kind of trudged through some fields to have a look where we are relative to that. But I suspect that it's not going to impact us too much. And most of the growers started planting the commercial onion crop somewhere around the 15th of March. Usually it takes about 3 weeks or 4 weeks for that crop to come up, you know, with the cooler temperatures that we have in the March, late March time frame. You know, and so we were about at that point where they were going to be emerging. Some of them may have been emerged. And so it's just a question now we'll have to kind of look at what kind of damage occurred as a result of that. And I haven't heard any negative things yet from the farmers, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we aren't going to see some variability that's going to show up as a result of it.
So for home gardeners, is it too late to plant onions from seed?
You know, we did some work last year that was kind of trying to address that question for the commercial farmers, because sometimes they run into these situations where, you know, the spring has been really good in March, so they get in, they get planted, and it's been nice and warm, and the crop comes up, and then we get some, you know, kind of bad weather that occurs in April. And the types of things that affect farmers don't necessarily always affect the home gardener in the same way, because, you know, the damage that we see on a commercial farm are tied to cold. So we get, you know, maybe a really heavy frost event or something like that, which injures the plant. Now that can affect the home gardener. The second thing that can happen is we can get a hailstorm and the crop is just coming up, and then you get one of these cold fronts and warm front kind of things that happen, and you know, you get some heavy rain with it, and if it's a little bit on the cold side, you get some hail. Now hail can affect the home gardener and it can affect the commercial farmer, but the third thing that affects more the commercial farmers and not so much the home gardeners is wind. And you know, in the home garden we tend to have structures, so we have buildings and outbuildings and garages and trees and fences and all of those kinds of things, so that while we do see the impact of wind in the landscape, you'll get broken limbs on trees, you might get some shingles blown off your home. Actually, in the vegetable garden itself, yeah, you'll get a little bit of plant movement, but it's not necessarily as serious as it is in a large field setting where the wind can move across that open soil And for an onion grower in particular, one of the problems we often see is sandblasting. And it's not necessarily sand, but it's soil movement that, because of strong winds, moves across the field, and those soil particles impact the growing plant that's out there. And particularly when the plant has just emerged or is in its early leaf stage, you know, can be injured by that, and that introduces potentially disease. The injury affects how well the leaf will grow in the future. If it's severe enough, it may actually shear the plant off. So the farmer himself, he looks at all of these types of things, and, well, we didn't have a lot of wind as they were predicting. So, you know, maybe soil movement wasn't so bad. We had some rain ahead of it, so that helps to actually consolidate the soil and hold it in place. It's when we have dry conditions and then lots of wind that you get more soil movement. And so we haven't had any hail per se, and we had a little bit of cold. And it kind of depends on what the crop is. Now, if you were transplanting some crops or something like that, if you had some cabbage or something like that, that was going out. And, you know, it's not an uncommon occurrence to have cabbage transplants and broccoli transplants going out into the vegetable garden in locations like Salt Lake Valley or Utah Valley and some of those warmer areas of the state. You know, they may have been injured a little bit by the cold. And that's why I say, you know, you have these things. And then you have any of your overwintering crops. Let's say you had some overwintering spinach or some overwintering lettuce or some overwintering onion. Garlic would be up, you know, those kinds of things. You know, they're sometimes, depending on how severe the cold is, you may or may not get injury. And so you're going to have to kind of go out and assess that, and you'll notice it. And it generally doesn't show up immediately. It's like in the next week, you'll start seeing some leaf margins that show a little bit of white color to them or a little bit of yellowish tone to them. And that's usually an indicator that there has been a little bit of frost injury that occurs on the plant. And it's kind of not so much what's happened to the older leaves. It's really what's happening to the growing point. Because if sometimes the growing point gets damaged, then you'll get this secondary branching that occurs. And that then is an indicator that there was some injury that occurred at some time in the past.
Well, let's go to a question that came in last week after the program was done. It's from Gretchen in southern Utah, and she said, you had some new gardening tips for me, such as planting onion seeds in the fall. I live in the Dameron Valley at 4,600 feet. St. George is a 15-minute drive downhill. We get some snow each winter, a skiff usually, but sometimes 6 to 8 inches, which melts off within the week. Do you have any suggestions on where to get wildflower seeds for this area, most similar to Cedar City? I'm especially interested in lupin, penstemon, and any other native Utah wildflowers. So my question is, as part of this, so can you plant onion seeds in the fall and get them to winter over?
Yeah, and that's it's important that you be careful about what varieties you select. And there are some overwintering types, and so when you go to a seed catalog and you start digging around in there, that's what you need to be looking for, these overwintering types, because they tend to be ones that we'd sow in the autumn. You know, for that particular region of the state, we'd probably be planting in late September, maybe into the first week of October. We'd get that plant established, and it would grow for several weeks through the autumn. And then, you know, the cold comes, and it essentially stops growing. Oftentimes, some farmers will, or gardeners will, mulch it a little bit, you know, put some straw out there, or, you know, do something to kind of give it a little bit of protection from the really cold time of the winter. And then it starts regrowing again, usually late February and through March. The key thing with those is, and then it's a very early crop. That's the nice thing about it. It's way early in terms of its maturity. So in July, it will be, you know, maturing off.
Will they be as big as they
would
have
been?
Yeah,
they tend to get as big. But it just is, the earliness is a nice factor that comes with these overwintering types. And then you would probably also at the same time be planting some in February down in that region for your autumn type of crop that would then be more for storage. And so you have these two different strategies that you're using to produce onions for a longer time for consumption at the at the home table. And so the key is the right varieties, because if you plant just what you normally would plant as a spring crop, if you plant it in the fall, that's okay. It will grow, but it gets enough. It's got leaves on it, and now during the winter, it's getting the chilling that is required for it to transition from vegetative growth, which is producing the bulb that we're interested in, that we'd store and consume. It no longer is in that vegetative mode. It switches over to a reproductive mode. And onion is a biennial plant. We've talked about that in the past, meaning that it grows 1 year, gets a cold requirement, and then it flowers in the second year. Well, we can accomplish that by planting it in the fall, and then it gets the cold that it needs in the winter. And then in the spring, it starts to produce a flower stalk.
So you can still get the swelling of the onion itself, but it is going to start to try to flower?
Yeah, but it doesn't swell up the bulb very much, because it tends to put all of its energy back into the flowering. And so these overwintering types, and they're are designed to do that not as frequently. So they've been bred, they've been selected for these other types of characteristics, which means that they can tolerate more cold and they don't necessarily go to flower.
So you want to look for a variety that specifically
says overwintering.
Because you can't just take any one that you would normally use.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so you need to be careful. So the gardener needs to kind of know why this is happening, and then look for the types that are more overwintering. They're not as common. So they're going to be a little harder to find, because not many gardeners overwinter them. Or you take the approach that, you know, I really like and use them more like a green onion, where you'll have some leaf tissue that you'll consume and, you know, a little bit of that swelling stem. They're going to flower. So then you could take just whatever variety you normally grow and kind of use them as a green onion crop, which comes much earlier than your spring planted green onion crop, and by that, you know, you kind of meet some of your table needs, rather than thinking about it as a storage type of crop.
So then in regard to Gretchen's question about flower seeds, wildflower seeds, do you have any?
And I'm trying to think. There are, and I don't off the top of my head know the name of these companies, but I know there are a couple companies in Salt Lake that sell garden seeds. And then I also think that there's this High Mountain seed company that's out of Idaho, and I know that they sell wildflower seeds as well, and that are would be more adapted to our particular area. I would suggest that if she's down there in that area, that she talks with either Rick Heffelbauer, our horticulture person in Washington County, or talk to Candace Gable in Iron County, and, you know, call the extension offices there, and they have access probably to some seed companies that might be more local.
And I know that growing crops for seeds for wildland rehabilitation was kind of difficult last year.
Yes,
so
and
there may not be a lot available.
Yeah, and there's a company over in Ephraim that kind of does some of that, and it's associated with I think with the Bureau of Land Management, and so sometimes they also sell.
Is that Great Basin seeds?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they may, you know, if you called Great Basin, they would probably know of places locally that sell those kinds of things as well, you know, because they're quite happy to share that information. They may not themselves sell it to you, but they would know of other places to get it.
Okay. Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist and my guest for the rest of the hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or tweet us your question, #AUGarden. So while we're talking about onions, is an onion considered a root crop?
No.
Okay.
It's actually, you know, it's kind of called a bulbing crop. Lots of crops are called those types of things, and they're not necessarily clear as to why that is, but essentially it's a swollen leaf base that an onion and a garlic is. So if we think about those, it's part of the leaf that is actually swelling on the plant. But because it creates this bulbous structure, we tend to call them bulb crops. I would prefer that we call it a leaf crop myself.
Really?
Yeah, because okay. It is leaf tissue that you're eating. It's just a different part of the leaf. So it's part, you know, you've got the blade part, which is the top part of the onion plant. Most of us never see that unless we grow them. And then the lower part of the leaf is what we call the sheath. And you have multiple leaves that are wrapped around each other. And about this time of the year, if you've had onions from last year, some of them are breaking dormancy and starting to sprout. And a new leaf is coming out of the center of the bulb. Or if you cut it open, you can start to see the center of it starting to green up a little bit as new growth is occurring in it. That's a natural occurrence that, you know, happens in these types of plants. So actually, when you're eating it, it's leaf tissue that you're consuming. So, you know, we have these kind of things in the, and it looks more like a bulb. You know, you think of it, oh, a tulip bulb. Well, a tulip bulb is really leaf tissue too that you are planting. And if it's true, something like a true bulbing type plant, we would say that would be more like a radish or more like a turnip in the brassica family. And that's tissue, that's swollen stem tissue. So in actuality, it's not, you know, if we're technically looking at what it is, it's part of the stem that's swelling. When you're eating a radish, you're eating stem tissue there. If you're eating a turnip, it's stem tissue that you're eating. And then if you get into something like a parsnip or a carrot, then what you're eating is actually true root tissue. So, you know, you kind of have to know a little bit more about your plant anatomy and then kind of look at where these things are occurring. And then we kind of give these, you know, generic terms to things. Well, it's swollen. It's a swollen root. Well, on a radish, everyone thinks it's kind of root, but it's really not. It's the technical term of what we're consuming is the hypocotyl.
You know? I love that.
Yeah, it's a good term because, I mean, I think we know what a hypodermic needle is. You know, we know our dermis is our skin, and hypo means below the skin, and the needle is actually putting something below the skin. So when you go for your tetanus shot or you're getting a flu shot or something like that, you know, they take a needle and they inject whatever they're doing into your arm or wherever, and it's below the skin. So we would call that, you know, basically a hypodermic type of needle. Well, this is hypocotyl, and the caudal part refers to the cotyledons. So it's this part of the plant that's just below the seed leaves, and the cotyledons are the seed leaves. So when you see a radish emerge, it produces these kind of heart-shaped seed leaves. And it's that piece of tissue, you know, just below that is actually swelling down to the interface where the root actually starts. And so it's what we would call hypocotyl region on the plant that is swelling. So we see that in turnips and most of those plants that are in the cruciferous family, which is the brassicas, which is the cabbages and cauliflowers. Well, radishes in that same family, and turnips are in that family, and rutabagas are in that family, and they all tend to swell. And kohlrabi, well, some of us know what kohlrabi is. Essentially, that's what we're eating.
So beets?
Beets are in a different family, but the beet does the same type of thing. Okay. It's that region below the cotyledons that actually swells up, stores the energy that's there, and that becomes a consumable part. And it extends down part toward the root as well, because if you look at and pull up a radish or pull up a beet, you get that root tail that's there. Yet it's really at that interface between where we transition from the root system to the stem tissue part of the plant. That is what swells up and stores the food that we're going to eat.
So we could eat them as we could be eating the roots themselves if we actually left them on, but usually we're like with the beet or with turnip, you're cutting off the root itself and eating that swollen.
That's right. Hypocotyl.
I love
it's
that.
It's a good name.
Add
to,
that to my list.
Add that one to your list. And so, yeah, so now when we're dealing with carrots, you know, if you look at the carrot and, you know, kind of follow its development, the crown of the carrot is where the growing point is, and all the leaves come out of an apical bud that is very compressed. And so if you think of the way the carrot grows, it has leaves that are coming out the top, and then you have what we call the shoulder, which is actually the hypocotyl region. And then you transition almost immediately as you go under the soil line into the root tissue. So there's a small amount of it. Generally, we cut that top part off because that's where the crown is and where the leaves and the root intersect.
Okay.
And we cut that part off. But that actually is swollen, so that's part of the hypocotyl region. And then the bulk of the root is filling. And that's the part that we consume on something like a carrot or like on a parsnip or something like that.
All right. So speaking of parsnips,
mm-hmm.
while we're there, last year I talked to you about the parsnips I had grown and they were just woody and just
yep.
like, I just didn't like them. And you said to make sure that they get consistent moisture
right.
was the key. So last year I planted them at the head of my garden where the water comes in, so they got water first.
Okay.
And all throughout the growing season, they were getting the water first, and the whole time I was basically irrigating, they were getting water. So I put leaves on them during the winter like I do my carrots.
Yep.
And went out and dug some in the winter, and by Jove, they actually tasted good.
And
they weren't woody. Yeah, I found a recipe for ground up parsnips to be put into a cake. So we're going to try that and see how that works out.
You know,
like carrot cake except parsnip
cake.
It's
a good thing that you listen to me. You know, if more people would just listen to me.
Are you kidding me? I've gotten more things from you.
Yeah, I know that. That's good because that's really the biggest problem with some of these plants is that, you know, moisture is critical, and if they get a dry period or something like that when the root is developing, then oftentimes, you know, they just kind of stop and they transition to, you know, bad growth rather than good growth, and they don't really, you know, maintain and store all those sugars that we want. And so that's good to know, and I hope our listeners understand that, you know, it's many of these root crops, it's little stresses that occur during the growing season that have a big influence on how well they store, what they taste like later on, you know, how woody they get, you know, how thick that cambial zone is, the storage part, you know, the center part is the xylem region of it. When you cut it and you see the ring in the middle of those, you know, that's where a lot of that woody part comes. And what you're trying to do is by keeping it hydrated, you don't let those cells, you know, lignify and become essentially woody.
So carrots seem to be a little more forgiving than parsnips.
Yep, they are. And so, you know, hopefully you've gotten your parsnips in the ground and you know, they are one that, like carrots, you know, we should have been planting those and getting that first crop in. You know, this cold weather is, you know, good for us and the moisture is good for us. So if they're in the ground, you know, they'll be, you know, emerging here in the next week or 10 days. And if you haven't really gotten them in the ground, you know, we still got a little bit of time, but often, you know, the later we get into April, you know, certainly if we wait until May, you know, the quality of the crop isn't that good. I had a question from a gardener down in Provo, and she was just complaining about how bad some of her root crops were and how bad some of her swollen stem crops were, or these bulbing type crops like radish and stuff. And, you know, she said, well, I'm, you know, planting them in May, and, you know, I would think that that's the, you know, they would do well. And, you know, my response to her was, well, you need to really move up your planting dates, because many of these cooler weather crops like to be planted in late March and into April. And if we wait until we plant them in May, then, you know, they emerge quickly. Well, we think that's good. But then they're also maturing in the time of the year when the temperature is much, much warmer. And as a result of that, the quality isn't there and the productivity level isn't there. And, you know, the compounds that the plant produces that are bitter type compounds or those heat compounds that we get in something like radish, you know, they just start to multiply in the plant. And as a result of that, we're unhappy with the quality of the product that's coming out of the garden and we're disappointed in it. And it's no fault of the plants. It's the person that's putting the plant in the ground. And so you need to kind of know what the appropriate planting dates are for these crops.
Well, we're going to talk about what makes a plant hardy. And when you see it can be planted between March 15th and May 1st, what does that really mean?
Okay.
When we come back, we're going to take a quick break, come back with the gardening calendar, and finish with Dan Drost here on Zesty Garden. Call us at 1-800-826-1495 or send us your email question, zestygarden@gmail.com.
If each year you find yourself trying to squeeze more plants into less space, it may just be time to expand one or more of your planting beds. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Start with a sketch of your garden and include the existing beds. Look at how you currently use the space and where there's room to expand. Once outside, lay out a rope or garden hose to help you further visualize and determine the final size and shape of the expanded garden. Then get out a shovel and start edging. This creates a clean division between the lawn and your garden. It also cuts the roots and rhizomes, preventing outside support for the grass and weeds you're trying to kill. Use newspaper and organic mulch to kill the existing grass without the use of chemicals. Spread a couple sheets of newspaper over the grass and anchor in place with shredded leaves, wood chips, or other organic mulch. Over time, the grass will die and the newspaper will decompose, adding organic matter to the soil. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from listeners and from the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, performing the music of Robert Kundick, including the Song of Nephi and his oratorio, The Redeemer, Saturday, April 20th in USU's Kent Concert Hall. Information is at AmericanFestivalChorus.org.
Welcome back to the second part of the Zesty Garden. And in our gardening calendar, there is a landscape design class. It's a weekly event being held every Wednesday from 9 to noon at USU's Botanical Center in Kaysville. Learn the basics of landscape design, such as how to draw, design, and choose the right plants for your own landscape. There's a private consultation with course instructors to review your plan that will be given on the last day of the course. All materials are needed, including handbook, graph paper, and design tools will be included. Information is at utahbotanicalcenter.org. Then there's a tried and true trees and shrubs class. It is this Saturday from 10 to 11 at the Tahnaquit Nature Center in St. George. Protect your investment. Instruction will be given on how to prune and properly care for your trees and shrubs. The workshop is free. For details, go online at sgcity.org. And then the Iron County Visitor Center is having a raised bed gardening class. That is April 18th from 4 p.m. to 5:30 at 581 North Main in Cedar City. Learn how to build and plant a successful raised vegetable garden. They'll teach you how to get the most out of the growing space, soil amendments to use, and what to avoid, varieties that work, and a lot more. Participants will have all the basic knowledge needed to start a garden of their own. They'll even give you a few plants to get started. The cost is $3 or free for master gardeners. Participants must register by calling the USU Extension office at 435-586-8132. And then the Ogden Botanical Gardens is on Saturday, April 27th from 9 to noon is having a What's Bugging Your Fruit Trees and Turf Grass class. Learn how to keep your fruit trees and grass healthy by controlling insects and diseases that can attack them. And just go to the Utah Ogden Botanical Gardens website for more information. All right, Dan. So here we have a book that's just come out this year. And yep. We talked a little bit about it last month, but why don't you go ahead and give me your 30-second promo.
Yeah, well, one of the most recent things that we had coming out is a new book that was put together with a couple of my colleagues, and it's called A Guide to Common Gardening Questions, step-by-step recommendations for successful vegetable and fruit production in northern Utah. And while it's for northern Utah at present, we are, as you might imagine, creating one for southern Utah, and that one will probably be out next year because what we need to do is, you know, modify a few things to deal with those warmer climes that are down there and do some adjustment on the planting dates. And you can go to the USU Extension website and to the what they call the CART, C-A-R-T, and look for that there. And it's for sale. Or you can go to your county extension office and generally purchase it at the county office as well. You can do many of these things online, as you might know. And what it provides is, you know, all of the kind of common problems that people regularly have and that we talk about on this program in a spiral bound, easily findable format that you can take out into your garden. Its paper is, you know, plastic coated so that it can get wet and do those kinds of things. And you can, you know, go right out there and, you know, be much, much more successful than you maybe been in the past. And so it has a lot of good tips. And one of them that I brought along with us today that I wanted to kind of chat about is, you know, this problem of people trying to figure out when to plant. And, you know, trying to come up with the appropriate planting dates for the particular crop that you're, you know, maybe most interested in your vegetable garden. And so I thought that would be, you know, a useful thing to do. We're in April and it's time to think about some of these things. And I had somebody said to me, should I start planting my tomatoes? You know, and I go, yeah, you know, you could do that. Do you have a greenhouse or a high tunnel? And they go, no, we're going to put them out in the garden. I said, we probably wouldn't do that if I were you, you know. And they were like, well, I've always planted around this time where I came from. Well, yeah, it's probably the first thing that you have to understand when you're thinking about planting date is where the heck are you? What is the climatic conditions of that? And what parameters of that climate do I need to kind of pay attention to?
Even here in Utah, if you lived in Salt Lake and moved to Cache County, well, you're going to have to go 2 weeks further back.
That's exactly
right.
So instead
of planting on May 1st, maybe you're going to be planting mid-May instead. Otherwise, you're going to find your plants
That's exactly right. And so that's the first key. You know, first of all, we need to kind of know something about where I'm at. And I need to know some parameters that are associated with that particular environment. And the types of things that you need to probably know are roughly when the last, you know, kind of average frost date is. When is the first frost date in the fall? You know, because those kind of give you a sense of the window in which you can grow the crop. And then after you know those parameters, you really kind of want to look at kind of a longer time frame and say, well, you know, that number that says, if we look at this publication, it says, well, if I was in Tremonton, the average last frost is May 3rd. So if I lived in Tremonton, that would be kind of roughly when I would maybe want to start planting certain crops. And then the question comes, well, which crops is it? You know, we'll get into that in a minute. So then what you really need to do is go find for your particular area, you know, kind of what the range is, because that only tells me what the average date is. Some years, averages mean some years that the last frost occurs earlier in the year, and some years it occurs later in the year. So it's kind of a window that you need to know, and that's, you need more information. So going to either the Utah State University's Climate Center and then saying, well, where do I live? And then looking for a weather station that's close to that, and then looking at a long historic record to say, oh, over the last 10 years, the earliest last frost date was, let's say, maybe April 20. And the latest last frost date is May 20, which gives me the May 3 to May 5 type of average. You see how that works. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you want to kind of know this window because that helps you maybe with a little bit of modification, you can do some things so that you can plant slightly earlier. Or at least, you know, for those crops that are a little bit more sensitive to frost, maybe I don't want to put those out until I get to this particular time.
Well, and it's even more, it's helpful to know even within a 10-mile radius of where you live. Okay, if I'm living in Trenton or Wellsville, I'm probably going to plant even later than someone who lives in Logan.
That's exactly right.
And you said Tremonton was what, May 3rd?
May 3rd,
well,
yes.
That's just over the mountain, but here I wouldn't.
We wouldn't do that.
10 days later.
10 days later, that's exactly right. So, you know, you need to do that, and, you know, you can go to the Climate Center website, and they have all of the major and minor and, you know, crossroads, basically, they know what those temperatures are, and you can find that. So if you live in Burrell Junction, you can figure out.
South of Milford?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you're out, you know, in the West Desert someplace, you can find this information. Or if you're in Salt Lake, you can find it for Holiday, or you can find it for Midvale, or you can find it for, you know, essentially downtown Salt Lake.
That's
pretty
useful because it's limited to just the populated areas.
No. This is not. And that's the beauty of it. But you need to do a little bit of looking. And the Climate Center has much of that information. And they have a Utah climate book that you can get or that you can look at online. And you can then find a city by you. And like you said, here, if we're in Cache County or if we're in North Ogden or Ogden or Farmington or West Haven or Hooper, all of those have a little bit different time frames, and therefore you need to not just rely on, oh, if I was in Ogden, it would do this, or if I was in Salt Lake, I would do that. Well, you know, those are big cities, and that means something completely different. So you want to kind of know the average, and then you want to know the earliest last frost date, and you want to know the latest last frost date, because that kind of gives you the window when you can kind of look at what's been happening in your particular area to help you make better decisions.
And the USU Extension website is, I cannot say how many times I've gone there. There's so much good information, and the easy access to it, is it gardens?
You can go through gardens.usu.edu.
Yep. Okay.
That's one way to get there. So, okay, now you've got kind of that temperature, you know, gives you something about frost dates and those kind of things. Then the next thing that you need to know is something about which group of plants you're particularly interested in. So we have plants that we call hardy plants, and the hardy plants are things like broccolis and spinach and peas and radishes. They can take a lot of cold, and they aren't impacted by that. Then we have what we call the semi-hardy or the half-hardy type plants, and those are things like carrots and lettuce and Swiss chard. They can take cold, but they can't quite take as much cold. And then we have the tender group, and the tender group includes things like beans and squash are in that type of group. And then we have the very tender group, and the very tenders are things like, you know, your melons and your tomatoes, your eggplants and your peppers, you know. So knowing now that we have these different groupings, then what we can do is we can start to say, well, when is it most appropriate to plant these particular crops relative to that last frost date? Well, the hardies and the half hardies or the semi hardies, we can plant up to 2 weeks or maybe even some cases 4 weeks or so before that. And in some cases, like with onion, it's in that very hardy group. I planted in March, and the last frost date I was planting in Tremont, and the last frost date in Tremont is May 3rd. So I can plant that way, way early and get that crop established because that plant will do what we want it to do. It'll germinate, it'll emerge, it'll grow. If there's a little bit of frost, it doesn't get injured by it, provided it's not, you know, really, really cold and, you know, nothing, you know, really puts up with that very well. And so, you know, some of these crops, when you look at it, then the thing says, well, what is kind of the planting window? So for these hardy type plants, the planting window basically from, south, let's say Nephi up to Logan, is somewhere between March 15 and May 1st. But that May 1st date, it's kind of dependent on where I'm at. And we need to know that, because that's where knowing when that last frost date is, kind of when that window is that I can start planting in. And so if I was planting something like peas, if I was in the Salt Lake Valley, I may be planting those on March 15. If I'm in the Logan area, I might not plant those until April 1st. And if I'm in a colder area like across the mountain in Morgan or someplace like that, I might not plant that until April 15. And so you see that, how it fits into that window. So it's really important to know where you are and what your conditions are like before you start saying, well, I could plant that on March 15. Well, in some cases, yes. And in other cases, no, depending on the plant itself. And so we give them windows because it's hard for us to say, well, for all of the cities that are in the state of Utah, we could probably develop a table that said that, you know, plant these on it. But think of all the vegetables that we grow. I have fact sheets for over 60-some vegetables. That means I have to have, you know, each one of those that kind of for each one of these cities. It's a pretty complex thing. So it's kind of up to the gardener to begin to know more about their environment, too, and know something about these plants. And so these are suggestions. And then you're going to have to kind of tweak them slightly based on where you at. So in Logan, I plant earlier than my sister-in-law, and she lives on the other side of Logan on the west side. It's a lot lower. It's a lot colder. So I always plant stuff, you know, maybe 10 days before she does. And when she tries to plant at the same time I plant, she always has problems. So, you know, you have to kind of be thinking about those kinds of things, too.
You're listening to Dan Drost on The Zesty Garden. We only have about 6.5 minutes left in the program, so if you want to get in a question or comment, I suggest you call us right now, 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question at zestygarden@gmail.com or tweet us a question, hashtag zestygarden. Okay, so now in the open to the program, one of the things I talked about was learning, well, what makes a vegetable and what makes a fruit a fruit? And and so why is a tomato, which is a fruit, a vegetable? I mean, how do you differentiate those?
Well, you know, do you want the scientific definition or the common definition?
Well, let's start with the common one.
The common one is that there is no real rhyme or reason for why they get classified as they get classified. Anything that produces a fruit on it that would be consumed in reality is really a fruit.
A fruit.
Yeah. So if you're eating a watermelon, what are you eating? A fruit. But it's in the vegetable family simply because most vegetables are grown as annuals rather than as like a fruit tree, which is a perennial and is going to be there for a very, very long time. And so, I mean, there is really no rhyme or reason. The only one that actually is in case law, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, if you can imagine this, is the tomato. And the tomato, there was a man in that was importing tomatoes from Cuba back at the turn of the century or before the turn of the century. And there was no duty on importing vegetables, but there was a duty on importing fruits. And so the tomato growers wanted it to be classed, or vice versa. I can't remember. I'd have to go back and rethink this. And
so he basically
wanted to save some money on his import stuff. And so actually it got classified by the Supreme Court as a vegetable. And as a result of that, I think what it did was it protected, you know, the local growers more so from this importation. And it was all about money. And as a result of that, the tomato, which is botanically a fruit, We're eating that receptacle that stores seeds, and essentially that's what fruits do. It doesn't make any sense, but it's a vegetable.
So beans are a fruit?
Actually, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, botanically they are fruits.
And
we got eggplants and peppers and melons and squashes and all of those things that are fruits. And, potatoes produce fruits. They flower and they'll produce a little berry on the top of them. Sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't. But do we consume that? No. So as you kind of go through the list, many of our warm weather crops, so if you're dealing with squashes or tomatoes or pumpkins or beans or cantaloupes, cucumbers, all of those are essentially, most of our warm weather crops are actually fruits, and most of our hardy and semi-hardy or half-hardy plants are mostly kind of thought of as vegetables, because by vegetable, what we really are meaning is we're eating stem tissue, leaf tissue, root tissue, rather than what we would say a fruit is, a reproductive structure.
So, but then that changes if you're looking at broccoli.
Yes.
Because then you're actually eating the flower.
You're eating the flower structure, but we're not eating the real fruit part of it.
Right.
So it's kind of there isn't really any good reason for the way we've classified
plants. Just planet needed.
That's right.
Don't worry about it.
Eat lots of it because we know it's good for you, and grow your own because we know that's good for you too, because you not only do you get the benefit of that nutritious food that's coming out of your vegetable garden, but there is a ton of evidence that shows that people that work in their vegetable gardens or their flower gardens or their yards have lower stress levels. People that, are bending over and lifting and turning and hoeing and doing all the things they do, those are good exercises to be involved in. So not only is the product that you're consuming good for you, but the exercise that you're getting from it is good for you. And the stress level that you get from it, plus the enjoyment of it, it's much better than, just plopping yourself in the chair in front of the television.
Of course, if you had my tiller last year, your stress level would have been a little higher than
what
normal.
Happened to your tiller?
it's a very good tiller. I've had it for quite a long time. It's just reaching.
It's time to go down and get a new one.
My wife would disagree with that, but.
Well, when she has to double dig a French bed, maybe if she was out there doing it, she might change her tune.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left, so okay. What is it too late to plant?
It's getting toward the end time for, planting onion seeds. It's a little, you probably could get by with it if you could get into your garden this week. Usually we find that later than that, we don't get very good production. Peas, it's kind of getting toward the end of the pea seeding time. You can still get by with some spinach or some lettuce and that type of stuff. And probably your parsnips is toward the end. So, they just need a long time. So, get on with it. And then it's almost starting the time to start transplanting. So,
okay. Well,
next month we'll talk about some new things.
Then. Dan, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, has been my guest. Stay tuned next week and we'll be back with The Zesty Garden.
The Gardening Show is produced by Shalane Smith Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. The Gardening Show is a production of Utah Public Radio. You're listening to KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.